The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics, as well as summer programs in ancient Greek, film studies, and Islamic classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
You are listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then tragically thought better of it. Our question for episode 117 is the truly universal question. If you want to bury your brother and your uncle won't let you, what should you do? And we read the play Antigone, coincidentally just about that, written by Sophocles in around 441 BCE. You can join the discussion. Get the text and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintonmeyer paying obeisance to the gods in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
I'm John Castro in Manhattan.
You have to say, this is John Castro.
This is John Castro in Manhattan, which is in New York City, by the way.
All right.
Start us off. Do we want ground rules to break the ice?
Safe word.
The ground rules for our discussion include, number one, try not to assume our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. However, we just recorded the play. So go listen to the play. You have no excuse. You don't have to read it. You just have to listen to it. And if you're not too distracted by our performances, then you'll get the meaning.
Well, you can at least enjoy Lucy Lawless's performance.
And Paul Provenza.
Hell yeah.
And Castro. But the rest of it's a it's a shit show.
Number two, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. Don't say, you would know what I was talking about if you'd seen the All Butter production of Othello.
All Butter?
I guess. It puzzles me. I haven't seen it.
Should we have a reading of that? Or is that more of a performance?
I think you have to be there to really get it. Number three, we'll be rigorous and exact in all that we say, unless doing otherwise would be potentially more entertaining. We got three St. Johnnies on. I'm outnumbered for the first time, and you guys did this thing at St. John's, your alma mater. Well, the undergrad alma mater for two of you, and Dylan was a tutor there. So what was that like? How did you treat this?
It's commonly part of the sophomore year, the first semester. It's commonly translated. Or at least big chunks of it are translated, along with reading it in the Greek. It's not done in seminar, as I recall.
We're not actually given much of this to translate, right? There were some preceptorials on it where you could translate the whole thing, but
I think it varied a lot from tutor to tutor. And certainly in sophomore year, not everybody did Antigone. Like, for instance, I did Oedipus Rex, not Antigone. But typically the pace would be start from the beginning and do, you know, like 10 lines a day and then jump ahead to some other section. It's very hard work translating it, especially if you don't know any Greek, which no one knows when they're a sophomore in college.
I think we did all three in seminar.
You mean discuss them, not translate them.
People might have been doing translations in their individual language classes, but if I recall, Antigone, Oedipus Rex, and I think Oedipus at Colonus were seminar readings. So I might be wrong about that.
The reason that I asked is because you're supposed to instruct me in this, how to talk about a play and not get all anal about finding enough philosophical content in it, right? I couldn't come up with a question out of this. I had to make up that bullshit fake ethical question for our intro here. Folks can go and listen to our not school discussion with the fiction group that I participated in on our citizen site about Antigone from last summer. And we came up with some things to talk about, but it was very difficult And people were sort of looking to me for guidance for how to wrench philosophical issues out of it. And other than the ethical thing that we already brought up in the discussion after the performance last time about conflicting duties and how maybe there are just conflicting duties and they're not defeasible. They're just both incumbent upon us. And that's just a tragic sense of ethics. So that was the big thing that I had gotten out of it. But apparently there's more to it. And even if there was less to it, you could just talk about it as literature and still have a stimulating St. John's-y style discussion.
The first thing is to not say we're going to wrench philosophical
exactly.
content. Exactly. Right. That's the very first thing.
That's very Creon-like of you, yeah, Mark.
Is that something that you find yourself doing with literature all the time?
Only when we try to talk about it on the podcast, which we haven't done that many times. So gotcha. We're establishing a precedent here. Last time we tried to do it was with David Brin and see what happened with that.
Yeah, but we did it with Cormac McCarthy, but I guess we had the benefit of having a philosopher who had written a paper about it on there who brought up Nietzsche and stuff like that, right?
So. Right. I looked what philosophers had written about this. I found a little about what Hegel had to say about it, and Wes found us a bunch of articles. I looked at the first one that are Freudian, so that was kind of neat seeing what somebody thought the unconscious motives of all the characters were that inspired some lines in the Antigone theme song that I wrote.
What I thought was really interesting, so as Mark pointed out, the classic conflict that this play has taken as representing is between the divine law and then the laws of human beings, let's say, or between loyalty to family and loyalty to state. But what interests me is so if you look at Creon's first speech, the play starts out, we get, you know, Antigone telling her sister Ismene that she's going to bury her brother despite the fact that Creon, who is their uncle and who has taken over the rule of the city after their brothers, who were co-leading that seminar, killed each other, basically. So they got into a fight, and there are different accounts of how that occurred. But one brother left the city and came back with an army, Polynices, and Eteocles, is that how you pronounce it, was defending the city and was killed. So Eteocles will be buried by Creon with full honors, and Polynices is going to be left out in the open, unburied, which was a very big deal at the time, a dishonor to the dead, and I think probably would still be a big deal today.
One of the descriptions of the conflict that I read was that Eteocles and Polynices had made a deal that after their father Oedipus was dead, you know, he had actually stopped being king even before that, then they would alternate years, that one would be the ruler for a year. So Eteocles was
right,
had his year, and then he was supposed to give up his reign, and he just wouldn't. And so Polynices left the city and started this rebellion. So really, if that is the correct account, you would think that's one of the things that Sophocles' audience would have had in mind. Then it seems like, you know, the one who's being dissed by Creon here was actually in the right in the conflict. But
right. The other thing to keep in mind that the audience would have had in mind is that, so these are all the sons and daughters of incest of Oedipus, and Oedipus actually has laid a curse on the two sons, and the curse is that they would kill each other. Yeah. Does anyone remember the reasons for the curse? It has something to do with something that seems quite trivial. He lays down some rules. So one of the brothers serves him using the silver table of Cadmus and a golden cup, and he had forbidden that. And then the other gives him the haunch of a sacrificed animal rather than the shoulder, and the shoulder's better. Basically gave him the wrong cut of steak.
Maybe if you fucked your life up so much, you know, killing your father and marrying your mother and then finding out about it and your mother kills herself and you blind yourself, maybe you shouldn't be setting rules like that. Maybe that's not the time to be presumptuous.
Or maybe those are the things you just start to focus on.
Yeah, maybe the need for rules, because of course the incest is the opposite of that, right? So it's the ultimate violation of boundaries is incest. So you could see those types of rules as an attempt to regain what you've lost through incest. When we get to the first speech of Creon, he's not framing his debate with Antigone in terms of justice versus familial loyalty or loyalty to the gods. He talks as if he's speaking about loyalty himself, and he's talking about loyalty to the fatherland, and he also talks about friendship, which he does repeatedly throughout the play. There are a few little things that Creon does that are repeated throughout the play. He's repeatedly accusing people of taking bribes.
Yeah,
but one of the other things and that's another thing for us to talk about, what the meaning of that is. And then what interests me most is this repeated talk of friendship. So he talks about being a friend to the fatherland and before you're a friend to anyone else. And then later on in the speech, this speech actually begins at like 162. And then how one's friendship to one's own land, to one's fatherland, is the groundwork for any sort of friendship at all. So he says, nor could I count the enemy of the land friend to myself, not I who know so well that she it is who saves us sailing straight, and only so can we have friends at all. So if you can't be a friend to your own country, you can't be a friend to anyone. So it's this interesting argument. What's interesting about this first speech is that it's a long kind of intricate argument in favor of his position, and he's trying to do a sort of reductio ad absurdum. Oh, you say there's some sort of higher friendship than friendship to one's country. Well, friendship to one's country is just the very groundwork of any friendship at all. So it's there can be no such friendship with it.
He makes a similar argument later on, maybe right after he and Hyman are done blasting each other. I think he says something to the effect of, if a man can't rule his house, how will he be able to be a decent ruler? I mean, I think it's very personally about him as king.
Right.
But I think maybe this is like the portal for more metaphysical concerns to enter the discussion or to sort of be pulled out of the play. But there's a cosmology to these duties, right? There's a way that they intersect and sort of chain all the way up to the gods too. And that the breaking of those duties is something that actually threatens the structure of the world. So if there's no peace in the house, there can't be peace in the kingdom. Or Wes is pointing out that without friendship to the state, there's no groundwork for friendship among friends. And that fissures in those, I don't want to say relationships again, but fissures in those duties to family, to friends, later on to the gods, actually complicate the picture everywhere. There's no way that a conflict in one area is isolated without a serious conflict somewhere else.
Well, I think it's interesting that you bring the relationship with the gods in and put it on the side of relationships among family and friends.
I kind of do, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the conflicts that's in here, because in some way, both Antigone and Creon are claiming a kind of allegiance to that.
Right.
Creon, in the sense of the order that's presented by the city, is one that's preserved and endorsed by the gods. And Antigone, that the familial ties and the proper death rites for her brother are endorsed by the gods.
That's right. And there's a moment where Creon, when he's confronting Tiresias, says the reason why all this is going down is that the altars themselves are polluted with the flesh of Polynices. His unburied flesh is polluting the altar.
Right. This is around 1,000... Somewhere in the early thousands that he's saying this.
I'm using the same text that we used for the reading.
Yeah, which didn't seem to match what Wes was reading.
I'm using the green translation just because it's very literal and it goes line by line.
Got it. Sorry.
And it marks all the lines.
My lines are marked too. I think this is around somewhere in the 800s. But the line that I'm thinking of is that he basically says, no man can defile the gods.
Actually, Creon, interestingly, says that as a response
that's who I mean.
So I wouldn't give him up for burial in fear of that pollution, for I know no mortal being can pollute the gods.
Right.
Old Tiresias, human beings fall. The clever ones fall the furthest when they plead a shameful case. This is another one of Creon's memes, the clever falling, and people who have taken bribes and things like that. But yeah, so Tiresias has given this idea that there's a pollution and Creon isn't buying it at this point.
And that pollution is connected to the duties owed among humans, right? The failure to meet the duties between human beings causes a corruption in the duty or the, let's say, the ritualistic practice that we owe to the gods, so that there's some connection there from high to low. I mean, you know that term, the great chain of being or something like that. But it's that this king is unjustly treating one of his, I guess, nephews who's passed on. The fact that he's not paying him the duty he is owed is actually creating a rift between the divine and the human.
Yeah, one of the things Tiresias says is, yield to the dead. There's this line from the dead to the divine. The idea that when mortals die, they go to Hades and they join So Antigone will talk about joining Persephone in Hades. And of course, she'll be joining Hades himself. There's some sense in which whatever form of afterlife this is a conferral of some sort of not divinity, but association with divinity. And there are things owed to the dead. And I think that's one of the conflicts here, is what's owed to the dead versus what's owed to the living. For Creon, it's about what's owed to the living, the people who have survived the war, the state. For Antigone, it's about what's owed to not just someone who's her kin, but also she frames it more generally in terms of what's owed to the gods and what's owed to the dead.
There's just a little mirror of that where I believe when they're discussing the two of them in the tomb, that Creon, you've denied the gods of the dead. You've denied them Polynices, right? You didn't let him die. And you're sending the daughter of the daylight or something, or it's some phrase like that. You're sending her into night far too early. So basically, he's flipped the order of things in the way they should be.
Yeah, Tiresias seizes on that irony of Creon's punishment for Polynices is a denial of burial, not burying someone who's dead. And then his punishment for Antigone inverts that. It's a burial for the living. When he makes that decree, by the way, you already see sort of hints of him having second thoughts. Why not just kill her? At first, he's more bold. I'm going to slaughter her on the spot. No one's going to make me a liar. Now he's kind of doing the James Bond villain thing, right? He's going to give her a chance to escape.
Also, yeah. Not take responsibility for her actually dying. It's a similar thing to exposing your child to death rather than slitting their throat, right? Somehow you have distanced yourself from actually killing them.
Right.
So that they can come back later on and kill you.
Exactly. I was going to say, you think this family would have given up on that tactic?
Right.
I guess I'm being a little speculative here, because I do think that Tiresias unambiguously indicts Creon. I'm wondering about that sense. Is he indicting Creon completely in every way, or is it more for the extremity of his reaction? Is it more like, well, you know, you had a point with Polynices, but look, he's dead, so you have, for the good of the city, everybody's against you, and you've made it worse by condemning Antigone. You made everybody else against you. Both of which are true. And so I'm wondering how much of Tiresias's advice has to do with the good of the city against Creon's understanding of what the good of the city is. He understands himself as preserving the integrity of the city, and that punishing Antigone is really part of laying down the law and maintaining order. And without that order, the city will fall apart. And Tiresias is saying, well, look, you are actually violating the necessary behavior of the city and therefore not ruling it properly. As opposed to it being about not properly appeasing the gods or something like that.
That's certainly the latter is how it reads. I've seen these ill omens on my altars, and you've brought this calamity upon us. Our hearths and altars are stained with the corruption of dogs and carrion birds that glut themselves on the corpse of Oedipus's son. So it's just you did the wrong thing, and the gods are now deaf when we pray to them. Their fire recoils from our offering. Their birds of omen have no cry of comfort, for they are gorged with the thick blood of the dead. And it doesn't seem to go in any more detail other than, Creon, why can't you just admit you're wrong? And why are you accusing me of making this announcement for profit's sake somehow? You know, so he defends himself against Creon's kind of crazy accusation.
Yeah, that comes up again.
Which he had against the century earlier, that right. Anybody that's defying him must have somehow been paid off by somebody. Like, as if Polynices has a bunch of financial backers or something.
So is what I'm remembering voiced by the chorus and not by Tiresias?
What are you remembering?
Which one?
I'm just remembering that the issue of Creon's behavior as being bad in two ways. One is that it's not just Antigone that is affronted by the act of not burying Polynices.
Hymen says, makes that point. Okay. This is how everybody in the city is talking about you.
Yes. Okay.
What are the two ways that he's done something wrong?
It's just up in the ante. I mean, I guess it's basically the same way. But the first way is not allowing Polynices to be buried, which he does on the grounds of integrity of the city and essentially the rule of law, and that the traitor Polynices had disrespected the order of the city. And so the way he goes wrong in that is not realizing that once he's dead, then there are some higher rules that the city operates under that must be adhered to. And there's a way for him to rule, but still allow him to be buried. And then same thing by upping the ante with Antigone. It's a similar kind of violation of trying to hold too tightly to the rule of law and the human conception of the city rather than sort of the divine origins of it.
What you just said, it brought together two questions that I had in my mind that I had thought were disparate, but I think that they're related now. What does he actually gain by refusing the burial? He has that speech at the beginning, and I'm sure somebody has a line, I don't have it close to hand, about how not honoring the ignoble dead is part of how you keep the state functioning. But before we get to that line, the question that I didn't relate to it before, but you said what you just said, but I see it now, is what is it about what Tiresias says convinces Creon? There's no compelling piece of information that sort of flips things for Creon in the way you might see in a different tragedy that I won't name because we weren't supposed to have read it, but everybody read it.
No, I thought it was that Tiresias tells him that a bunch of your loved ones are going to die. And that was basically what has him unsettled.
But that's what's funny about it, because you're right. That's what he says. This house is going to be filled with all sorts of men and women weeping. This is, I guess, this is 850 in the edition that we used when we read it. Curses will be hurled at you from far cities grieving, for sons unburied left to rot before the walls of Thebes. These are my arrows, Creon. They fall for you. All right, kid, let's get out of here. He heads out. And the chorus says, it's almost comic in the way it's written. The chorus is like, you know, he's gone, but you know what? He's always right. And Creon's like, you know, that's right. I'm troubled by that.
Right. That you know his prophecies, I mean? Come true. That's one of the first things Creon says is that.
Maybe it's just that Tiresias has gone into prophecy mode and that's enough. That once he starts doing whatever little dance he does when that happens, it's, you know, that something real is being handed down. But I still didn't understand what it was that flipped the switch for Creon.
It's just the combination of, like, when Tiresias is challenging him directly, then he can't accept that, because whatever the benefits of him saying that Polynices should not be buried, once he said it, then to go against it is to itself defy the state and to violate personal loyalty. And everything becomes very personal.
Right.
That Antigone has personally betrayed him. He even accuses Ismene of personally betraying him because she's the sister. She must have been in on it. A snake in my own house. So when Tiresias does the same thing, then he accuses him, you know, you must be telling this because you've been paid off. And it's only when he goes that he can kind of let it not be a personal confrontation with Tiresias anymore. When it's the chorus, the choral ghost explaining, giving the line, the old man is gone, but his words remain to plague us. And so this makes Creon finally say, it troubles me, but oh, it is hard to give in,
yeah,
but it's worse to risk everything for stubborn pride. So he's able to finally self-reflect for the first time. And once he does that, like, it just takes a little bit of pushing from the chorus to get him to completely switch around. Although Chorgo says, you know, take my advice. What shall I do? Go quickly, free Antigone from her vault, and build a tomb for the body of Polynices. He should have done it in that order. Because
yeah,
he doesn't.
No,
they go
right.
And then when the messenger tells the story, they mess around with collecting all of Polynices' body parts, because by that point he's been ripped apart, and burying them and doing all the stuff before they ever go to the tomb. They actually do take a lot
point.
Of time. It's odd.
So before we go any further, we've already talked about how this is kind of reflective of your St. John's experience. Because St. John's is actually our sponsor this time, right?
Yeah. This episode is sponsored by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. So we want to give a shout out to our friends there.
In Santa Fe.
So the Graduate Institute, it's a master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland, actually. It's at both campuses. What I did was the undergraduate program, and John Castro did this as well, which is a 4-year program. This is actually a 2-year program, but it's very, very similar to the undergraduate program. It's all seminars, and it's all taking what we call the great books, classics of Western and Eastern civilization, and sitting around a seminar table with like-minded people and having a discussion. So instead of having a lecture, it's a discussion. St. John's seminars are much different than the typical graduate seminar. They attract a certain kind of person, and they are not run with as heavy a hand as a typical graduate seminar, where really the professor is running the show.
When Wes said that it attracts a certain type of person, it's a type of person who has an intense dedication to focusing on the product of the conversation rather than the agenda that you bring to the conversation. So to me, it always felt like I was sitting there with a group of people who were working intensely to figure out something about the world, and that these books were a window or a focus for us to reach that point.
So the Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications for the summer of 2015 and subsequent terms. Those applications are accepted on a rolling basis. There's no fee. And the only requirement is that you have a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree granting programs, the Graduate Institute also sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week ancient Greek course, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. If you are a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
This episode is also sponsored by QuickBooks Self-Employed. You're probably familiar with QuickBooks, super popular do-it-yourself accounting software. If you work for yourself, you're going to want to use QuickBooks Self-Employed, and you can save up to 50% of an entire year's subscription to it. QuickBooks Self-Employed helps you separate your business and personal expenses. You can quickly track what you spent for work and what you spent on yourself. You're putting mileage on your car, your internet, you're buying food. QuickBooks Self-Employed is going to help you track those kind of expenses. QuickBooks provides you the tools to help you maximize deductions like home office and mileage. It also helps take the guesswork out of your estimated quarterly and year-end taxes. So come tax time, you know how much money to set aside for Uncle Sam and how much stays in your pocket. Find out what QuickBooks Self-Employed can do for you and receive 50% off at tryselfemployed.com/PEL. That's tryselfemployed.com/PEL. Thanks to Intuit QuickBooks for supporting the Partially Examined Life. And now back to it. We were talking about Creon's point of reversal.
Real quick, what Mark was saying, like the next thing that Creon says is he asks the chorus for permission, right?
Yeah. It's an interesting sort of chorus because it sort of accedes to everything he says until the very end. But sometimes there are little ironic hints. So there's a reticence or there's an ironic hint. For instance, after Creon's first speech, the response of the chorus in the very literal David Green translation is, "This resolution, Creon, is your own." So he's been talking as if he's the representative of the state. And there are lots of those little ironic jabs in the chorus's replies.
Antigone being led away to her doom is just prior to Tiresias coming in. And that seems to be what turns it around, is that she's so popular. And so you have this ode number 4 that you guys read that just reflects on how tragic and how like the tragic things in the myths, in their religion, what's happened to Antigone. So I think that's really where it turns around, where they actually see, maybe they thought he wouldn't go through with it, or you know, there would be some way to settle this and not just condemn her to death. But even before that, with Hymen, the Chorgo says, pretty much you're both being wise here. You should listen to each other. So already it's shifting.
Yeah, Hymen definitely softens him up.
The irony of, there's this line that the sentry has, this is right near the beginning. I think it's when he brings Antigone in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if this is right before he takes off to go find who did it, or if it's right before he leaves after Antigone's been caught, but he says something to the effect of, there's nothing more comfortable than a safe skin, even if you're turning in a friend. You might be turning in your friend to the authorities.
That's after.
That's after he's brought Antigone.
Yeah, one's own escape from trouble makes one glad, but bringing friends to trouble is hard grief. Still, I care less for all these second thoughts than for the fact that I myself am safe.
Which I like the other translate, yet I always say, there's nothing so comfortable as your own safe skin.
There you go. That, in a way, like, you see the effects of, you know, because, again, that whole thing of Creon's always accusing people of being bought off, which it seems like such a foreign element in this play, right, to me, because you don't see any examples of that happening at all.
Well, the corporations are working behind the scene.
It's, right.
Well, it speaks to his paranoia. He's suspicious of the motives of others, so we could talk more specifically about why it's money. But I think the main thing is it's a matter of his sense that others are not acting in good faith. That's an interesting contrast because it relates back to what you asked, what did he have to gain from prohibiting the burial? And I think in the beginning, I think Creon is acting in good faith. At a certain point, it becomes pride. But the initial order, I think he's acting in good faith. And I think he sort of, once he's challenged, it's just everyone else is acting on bad faith and I'm the only one acting on good faith. So he sort of, in his own mind, hoards all of that to himself. But I think this whole speech about, so he's just become the ruler and he had to figure out what to do in this situation. And he gives a long reasoning about why he did it. And he's, you know, he's saying things like, You cannot learn of any man the soul, the mind, and the intent until he shows his practice of the government and law. For I believe that who controls the state and does not hold to the best plans of all, but locks his tongue up through some kind of fear, that he is worst of all who are or were. So essentially, this is his first challenge as a ruler, and he's got to show that he's a good ruler. He's come to the decision which he thinks is actually going to demonstrate his goodness. That's the, I think, part of the tragedy here. It's not just an ill-conceived sort of command. There's a definite logic to the command. It's one way of looking at things. It's in the interests of justice. It's a way of punishing someone who seemed bent on destroying the state. It's a way of honoring the state. This is what's on his mind in his first decree as ruler.
Yeah, and there's yet another translation, but it's, these are my principles at any rate, and that is why I've made the following decision. In the, I guess this is in the Loeb, Hugh Lloyd-Jones. These are the rules by which I make our city great. So
yes, yeah.
That way of saying it gets to what you're saying.
Yeah, this in the green, it's with such good rules shall I enlarge our state. Which I like that because it's ambiguous between enlarging his own state, enlarging himself. You know, there's always the question of whether he's acting on behalf of himself or the city, and whether he is the city. He'll say things later on in his dispute with Hyman where he's identifying himself with the city, which of course is the constant temptation of someone who's in a position of power.
Well, I mean, if you're going to be at pains to identify yourself with the city, then you need to identify yourself with everyone in the city. And there's this, just this thing that he, you know, I'm probably more attuned to this just because I'm a 21st century individual, but the way he continually isolates women and the youth from the right or the ability to make decisions or to add their counsel to his decisions, right? It actually, there's one kind of telling moment where Creon says, my son, he says to Hyman, you've sided with a woman? And Hyman says, if you're a woman, yeah. Which is, of course, like, you know, a little bit of a shout out to Tiresias, whose mythological nature is somebody who flips between those two sexes.
Oh, really?
Did that inform your performance, Dylan? Did you know that?
Couldn't you tell?
Well, I noticed you tried to, it says,
I tried to be sing-songy at
first,
the beginning.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes, on the first line. Yeah. It's sing-songy in contrast to Creon. Yeah. Yeah. And that's hard to do.
Yes, hence it was terribly done. Well, don't you think, though, that, I mean, this is where, you know, having the context of a little bit of the other plays makes a difference. Right, Tiresias.
Which the audience didn't have, right? Because this was produced first.
Well, no, but the audience.
Of course, the audience knew the stories. I mean,
you know the story, yeah.
You're right. It was produced first.
Tiresias' nature would have been something they were all aware of.
Yeah, and all these stories are the kind, it's like the Odyssey or the Iliad or something. I mean, if you grew up here, you would never have heard it the first time. Everybody knew these stories before they even, you know, knew them.
It's like a Spider-Man reboot.
I was about to say that. It's like what Batman is to us.
That's exactly right.
For better or for
Spider-Man
worse.
And Sophocles.
Hey, kiddies, let me tell you a story about a man who fucked his mom. This is a children's story? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying, you know, I was actually, this is just a side note, but I was actually like getting really kind of offended by the number of reboots. And you sit there and you're like, is this all the creativity that we have? You know, that we're constantly actually remaking the same movies about the same people. Until a friend of mine pointed out to me, he's like, well, you know, why is this really any different than the way you would have experienced stories in different media about the Trojan War.
Or 80 different versions of Hamlet.
Or the Bible, for that matter.
So part of that backstory is that Oedipus was, before his fall, a fantastically successful king and highly esteemed in his country, having come in after the death of their ruler. No one knowing, of course, that Oedipus was the one who killed him. And that, you know,
solving the riddle of the Sphinx.
Yes. Yes. He's all the riddle of
the
Sphinx.
So he saves Thebes from the Sphinx. And Creon is actually ruler at that time in Laius' stead. And so he awards him rulership because of that.
He also awards him his sister.
That's all good, important stuff to why Creon would be trying to assert himself in some very concrete manner. So, you know, him saying, these are the rules and the way I will make this city great, then that's him asserting that. So I guess I'm just going back a few minutes to agreeing with Wes that at the beginning, if maybe ill-conceived or maybe a little bit over the edge, his initial rhetoric is just one of just saying, look, this is the way we will make the city great, and by sort of laying it down, being a strong ruler.
I should say, I don't know how long he's been ruler at this point. It's not his first decree, obviously. It's, well, is it? I don't know. Because it's Polynices and Eteocles have been rulers. So maybe we can't consider this his first decree. But it's only ill-conceived in the context of Antigone. That's another
interesting thing about this play.
Is it his tragedy or hers? At a certain point, all our feelings, we feel sorry for Antigone.
But she's not the one who falls, really, right?
No, not at all. She doesn't change.
And she's not the one who makes the big mistake. You know, Creon's the one who makes the big mistake. And
well, I think that's up for debate, though. Because in some ways, she's in a similar position to Creon, acting from a point of pride. Although I'm not actually asserting that. That's the possibility that's always looming over this, which is that she is being just as prideful as Creon.
They're very similar.
Yeah. Her problem is not giving enough room to the rule of the city and apologizing and living with it. You know, she got the burial, and so to live with it, sort of according to Mark's song, you know, why couldn't you just have apologized? It wouldn't have been that big a deal.
She talks of wanting to die.
Well, I was convinced, yeah, by this article that you pointed us to, this Renato Almansi, a psychoanalytic study of Sophocles' Antigone. We can send people the link to that if they're curious. But yeah, points out this, friend, shall I lie with him? Yes, friend with friend, when I have dared the crime of piety. This is right at the beginning when Ismene won't help her. So the article is asserting that she had a thing for him, that it was an incestuous desire, and that what in Freudian terms wanting to lie next to or to join in death means is to sleep with them, to want to have sex with them.
And the ultimate psychological significance of that urge is to essentially a return to a point at which you are no longer an individual. It's a return to the womb, or to what psychoanalysts call the pre-Oedipal. So that's the, I just wanted to, if we're going to talk about incest, that would be the larger psychological significance of incest.
If we are thinking in terms of tragedy, there's a mechanical element to it. And this is where I'm actually going to speak against everything I said, or I only said it once, but I kind of wish we had done a little bit of reading in the Poetics in terms of the way Aristotle would have defined it. You don't need Aristotle to see this, but the focus of the climax of the play and the forces in the play that are acting toward a new state of equilibrium are all converging on Creon. If we're trying to figure out who the tragic figure is, it's the person on a theatrical level that is the focus of the mechanism of the tragedy, right?
Well, explain that more. I admit I'm probably defining tragedy too broadly, or tragic figures too broadly, and maybe what rules out Antigone as the co-tragic figure.
On a very basic level, without, again, engaging in theory of drama or tragedy, he's the one in the play that suffers change. And
so he sees the error of his ways at the end.
There's a realization. My Aristotle is just way in my past. But I know a practicing playwright, David Mamet, actually, who would structure his plays along a mechanism where the thing he was shooting for was the moment of reversal of fortune is the same moment as the recognition of one's own complicity in that reversal, right? That's why I asked that question about, like, why does Creon find what Tiresias says compelling? I asked that question because I don't feel like this really binds those two moments together. It's that sort of a mechanism on the most basic level. Somebody who was high is laid low. I just think Antigone is really a solid block of stone. I think she's a very well-drawn character. But she just trucks through.
An irresistible force,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. And if we're going by Aristotle, this is straight out of Aristotle. So the reversal of fortune in ancient Greek, it's called the peripeteia. And it's exactly the point at which the character also suffers and then realizes and comes to that realization. So maybe Mark was right. Sorry, Mark.
You know, I actually, with my daughter, just watched a Brady Bunch episode that had the same thing, where Peter was a hero, and he was declaring himself a hero, and he threw a party for himself, and no one would come. And then he's standing there in this goofy-looking late 60s suit, staring at the table full of party favors and crap that nobody's at, and that's the moment where he...
His peripatetic moment.
He suffers change, yes.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I didn't know that was so informed.
I thought it was
by Aristotle.
When Marcia got hit in the face with the football, but
That is a change. That is a laying low.
If we're going to talk about Antigone as tragic in any sense, it's not in this very strict sense.
It does beg the question of why it's called Antigone and not called Creon.
Totally. Totally. Do we actually know?
Marketing purposes.
Actually, that's a good question.
I am not showing up to Creon.
Exactly.
I don't want to see
that. Well, no, but it is a good question of what the actual name was. I don't know.
I think it was Choragos. I think that was the name of the play.
The question
is, Tiresias.
Do you want to see Paul Provenza or do you want to see Lucy Lawless?
Sorry, Paul.
There you go, Paul.
Well, let's look at scene 4 where Antigone has her final talk to see if she has any sort of reversal or anything. I mean, it just seems like it's a long, broken up, mourning farewell. Look upon me, friends, and pity me, turning back at the night's edge to say goodbye to the sun that shines for me no longer. Now sleepy death summons me down to Acheron, that cold shore. There is no bride song there, though, or any music. And all the rest of the speeches are about the same.
And we should point out that she doesn't perform in them in that mocking tone.
No, Lucy did a good job of being serious about it.
So, yeah, I mean, I think this is also very interesting. You could argue for some sort of subtle reversal in the speeches here that she gives at the end. She's certainly in a different frame of mind, right? She's certainly not in the, fuck you, I'm going to do this and I don't give a shit. She's now in a state of mourning, but it's no longer directed at her brother. It's directed towards herself, at her own fate. This idea, I'll never get married. And
Oedipus, it finally brings back in like the third speech where the chorus says, I cannot tell what shape of your father's guilt appears in this. You have touched it at last, the bridal bed, unspeakable horror of a son and mother mingling, their crime, infection of all our family. O Oedipus, father and brother, your marriage strikes from the grave to murder mine. I have been a stranger in my own land. All my life, the blasphemy of my birth has followed me.
Why Hymen? Like, why is he here? What's the importance of the marriage that's getting interrupted? Like, that reference that you just read, Mark, clearly is connecting the original, quote-unquote, marriage sin with what's happening to her now as sort of a fate passing down. Seamus Heaney expresses it beautifully. He says, fate is breaking upon this family like a wave cresting up and dredging up all of the black sand at the bottom and crashing that black muck down onto this generation, right? Maybe I'm being a little precious here, but I'm just curious like what the marriage is about. Why does it need to be interrupted? Why do we even have her as a bride to begin with? Could we have done without it technically in the play?
So there's something important about love, I think. And the chorus gives a speech about love.
What's love got to do with it, Wes?
I think that song is one of the translations of passages of this play.
So the chorus is talking about, this is right after the fight between Hymen and Creon, just after 780. So Creon is just given the decree to take Antigone away. And the chorus goes, love unconquered in fight, love who falls on our havings. You rest in the bloom of girls' unwithered face, blah, blah, blah. You twist the minds of the just. The wrong they pursue and are ruined. Desire looks clear from the eyes of a lovely bride. So the idea here, of course, is that Hymen has been corrupted by love. But I think it speaks to this larger idea that it's Antigone's love for her brother, that that's something excessive and wrong about that. And that's directly contrasted, at least here implicitly, to her love for Hymen. And then, of course, in her speeches, she will talk a lot about the fact that she's never, not for me was the marriage hymn, nor will anyone start the song at a wedding of mine. Acheron is my mate. So this idea of death being her lover. So this attraction in the very beginning to death, this attraction to her familial tie to her brother, that stands in tension with the desire that brings you outside of the family. So you can see, again, this sort of mirrors this idea of the incestuous family tie could be incestuous versus the desire for others outside of the family versus one's loyalty to family and state and nation versus one's loyalty to laws that transcend that. It's still along the lines of those same sorts of conflicts. But I think this idea of love here and marriage is actually important.
We should throw out that Hymen is family, though. He's a,
he's a cousin.
Cousin, yeah. Right? Like half-cousin, if there's such a thing.
Yes, and I bought another thing that came out of the Almansi article, is that Creon's tone with his son about this, and I'm going to take your bride away from you, that Creon actually does have a thing for Antigone. I couldn't really see that so much in the text, but it does seem an explanation for the vehemence. And supposedly, I guess I haven't read Oedipus at Colonus recently, but that he's very possessive, Creon, of both the sisters in that.
I don't see the attraction. What I see is what you would see in any situation, which is that the prospect of losing a son, right? Every marriage out of the family, he's holding on to his son as a son at that point. That seems psychologically plausible to me.
Can I throw a question just to keep looking at this relationship between, or not relationship, between Antigone and Hymen? This would just be a shadow hanging over the play, I guess, but like any sort of sense that their marriage would lead to some sort of political restoration or some sort of return to or reuniting of the line in some way?
You mean like Antigone would somehow legitimate Hymen above Creon in some way?
Well, legitimate the line. I don't know Hymen above Creon, but Hymen when his time would come, and actually thereby legitimate Creon immediately.
I see. You're thinking, John, in the context of just why this marriage in the first place, as opposed to why might Creon have other reasons for wanting to seize the moment to be opposed to it.
Yeah, in other words, they're probably including the marriage as a device for the play, right? As a mechanism inside the play, if he's a good playwright, and Sophocles is like the greatest, right? He's putting it in there for a reason that sort of sets up some markers for us to understand the rest of the play by. One part of it would be the things that Wes was outlining in terms of this very complicated familial morass that this whole crew is sort of wrapped up in. But another part of it too is that that same morass or difficulty would be echoed in the structure of the state itself, right? So when we're done with this play, what do we have left? We have Creon and no heir to the throne. But if Hymen and Antigone had been allowed to be married and consummate their marriage, you would have actually had Laios as heir.
So in the sequel, then Creon marries Ismene and they live happily ever after. Is that?
I mean, don't you have two options? So you were wondering, John, why this plot point at all? So you could imagine that Hymen didn't exist at all, and it was all on Antigone and her conflict with Creon. So then you have the problem of, like, you know, who is part of prodding Creon besides Tiresias? And Hymen has a huge role in that. And then if you just had Hymen in there as that role, but not have the marriage, which I thought was the other point, that why do they have to be getting married? Then I guess you get to where Wes is about the question of love, that isn't their tie that is related to another version of friendship, right? It's either a familial tie or another kind of loving tie that isn't part of the structure of the state, or it's part of this old version of the structure of the state. I guess I'm still stuck on this idea that the mistake that is being made by Creon is not understanding that the state is born out of the family, and that he is overreaching in the notion of an external rule of law or of the king over the people, and not paying proper respect to the rule underground. And I desperately, desperately want to refer to another Greek play, but
you know, it's interesting, though, when I'm thinking here of the sort of the communitarian argument, right, of grounding justice and identity rather than abstracting from identity. I don't think we necessarily have to go down that route.
I think we could go down that route, but I think we should do that in part two of our discussion. I think for the non-citizens, this is the end of the road for the moment until next week.
Dun, dun, dun.
But if you become a PEL citizen, you can go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and log into your citizen account. You can get the whole thing right now. You don't have to wait. And you won't have to hurt any commercials.
Wait, I had something really important to say.